You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello out there in archaeology podcast land. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel. I'm the president and founder of the California Rock Art Foundation. And what we do is we identify, evaluate, manage, and conserve rock art both in Alta California and in Baja California. We conduct field trips, we have trainings, exercise, we do research, and in every way possible, we try to preserve, protect, and coordinate treasures of Alta and Baja California rock art, of which there are many and diverse. We also work closely with Native Americans and partner with them to recognize and protect sacred sites. So for more info about the fabulous California Rock Art Foundation, you can go to carockart.org. Also, I'm open to give me a call, 805-312-2261. We would welcome sponsorship or underwriting, helping us to defray the costs of our podcasts, and also membership in California Rock Art Foundation. And of course, donations, since we are a 501c3 nonprofit scientific and educational corporation. God bless everyone out there in podcast land.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions.
Well, hello out there in podcast land. This is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel. We're introducing the Rock Art Podcast, episode 37. And this is one you don't want to miss. I'm unveiling some of my newest and most cutting edge and extremely controversial ideas regarding the revolutionary meanings of Coso rock art, taking it back to its earliest archaic roots.
All right, everybody. Welcome to the Rock Art Podcast. I'm Chris Webster, and I'm again interviewing Dr. Alan on his podcast. As we mentioned in the introduction, we are going to talk about Coso rock art and some things that you've been working on and thinking for the past, you know, much of your life working in this region. So let's first place the Coso range for those of that might not have heard our episodes talking about it, or maybe this is their first episode. Well, like, what is Coso rock art? Who are the Coso people? Where were they? Let's have the whole story.
So Coso rock art on the world stage is one of those areas that has world-class rock art. It's in Eastern California. It's on the very westernmost edge of the Great Basin, kind of in Eastern Kern and Southern Inyo counties. It's a principally volcanic area. It's in an area that's along the eastern skirt of the far Southern Sierra Nevadas and only gets a few inches of rain each year. It's a couple of valley systems away from Death Valley, which of course is one of the hottest and driest places on Earth for a variety of reasons. I understand that it has the world's record for being one of the hottest places that people have recorded temperature, 135 degrees ground temperature at one point. But Coso is recognized worldwide because of its unusual density or proclivity. The amount of rock art there is rather astounding. Conservative estimates, 100,000 individual elements in an area about 100 square miles. That estimate has been doubled recently to about 200,000 images as a minimum. And also because it is highly realistic or representational. So there is a lot of imagery. About half the imagery are depictions of animals or people or other figures and other subjects that people can at least appear to understand or represent. I would say about half of them are bighorn sheep, but there's also a class of decorated animal humans. There's deer, there's chuckawalla, there's people dancing, there is hunters, both with bows and arrows and with darts. There's depictions of darts, points, on and on. There's dogs chasing bighorn sheep as they're hunting. There's quail depicted. What am I forgetting? Oh, and there's many, many serpents, you know, pictures of rattlesnakes and other sort of figures as well. And many of these depictions are panels or, you know, graphically quite captivating and amazing. By many estimates, Coso has the greatest density of rock art in the entire Western Hemisphere. So that means there's a lot of it in a small area.
What do we know about the age of the coastal rock art again? Like how,
I think when did they, yeah,
yeah.
We can all agree that the rock art has been crafted for about, you know, the very late Pleistocene or early Holocene for the last 10,000 years through historic times. The bulk of the rock art was probably crafted, I would say, during the middle Holocene or middle Archaic to about the earliest part of the late prehistoric. Let's say from about 6,000 BC to about AD 1000. I know that's a huge slash of time, but the Koso artisans were busy and they seem to have been very active, especially during what they call the Newbery period, which is about 2000 BC to about AD 1. And it seemed to have even picked up in activity during that last spurt of activity or fluorescence from about AD 1 to about AD 1000 or 1300.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. A lot of pictures, a lot of activity, beautiful imagery. It's principally on basalt, on lava flows. The area is very volcanic. It is also a geothermal area. Koso Hot Springs is a thermal pool of bubbling 200 degree Fahrenheit water that exists where the geothermal facility is that produces energy sufficient to run a city or two. So
yeah,
all of that and much more.
Yeah, absolutely. And some of it is locked away onto a secure Navy base that we've both been on, because we've talked about Little Petroglyph Canyon and some of the other sites around there where just the site density and the rock art panel density is so high in that canyon. It's just phenomenal.
Yes. One of the reasons it is so, I guess, known or recognized and considered a real treasure is because it's locked behind gates. It's one of the most secure places, probably in the United States entirely. It's it's where we develop the weaponry, the drones and the missiles that we use to protect our nation and deal with some of the terrorism issues that we've had. And so since the 1940s, the area has been locked up and protected, which is rather interesting. It kept it rather in good shape and in tremendous high quality and high preservation. There are herds of wild horses and other animals in the base. And the area is, besides being rich in archaeological sites and rock art sites, it's also rather impressive when it comes to the biota and the flora, because it's very well preserved and extremely beautiful.
Right.
For those who like the desert.
It's definitely a unique landscape. Having spent the last, I don't know, 7-8 months on the East Coast, basically, of the United States.
Yes.
I'm currently in Massachusetts, right on the border of New Hampshire.
Uh-huh.
Man, such a different environment compared to that. It's
like
so amazing.
Like night and day, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely.
My mother-in-law had never seen a Joshua tree. And so these are those thorny that when the immigrants saw them, they looked at the branches and said it looked like Joshua himself was throwing out his arms towards the celestial or divine sphere. So they called them Joshua trees. But when my mother-in-law saw them, she was provoked and said, "That's a poor excuse for a tree. That's not a tree. Where's the leaves? Show me the shade. Show me the shade. Show me the shade, Alan." Yeah. So, anyways, this Koso rock art on the world stage, having to do with rock art controversy and rock art research, has been front and center, showcased, relating to the various alternative platforms for explanation regarding rock art, including shamanism, including altered states of consciousness, hunting magic, looking at the panels for understanding of mythology and creation stories of the indigenous people, issues of prehistoric population movements and replacement. I could go on and on. So there's a variety of research questions that center on our understanding of Koso rock art, also its age, antiquity, and subject matter, and how to best interpret it and understand it.
Well, how about we leave that as the stage setting before we get into the really the major topic on the other side of a break? I think we should do that. That way we can have an unfettered discussion about our primary topic for today. So let's take a break and we'll see you in a minute. Welcome back to episode 37 of the Rock Art Podcast. And we are talking about Koso rock art, but more specifically, some of the things you've been thinking about and revelations you've had about Koso rock art in recent years as a result of all your years of study on it. So in segment one, we kind of set the stage. If you, for some reason you didn't hear that, go back and listen to segment one. We talk about Koso rock art. If you happen to find this episode, you know, part of the way through, go check that out. And then let's bring back our major topic for discussion here. So where are we going with this?
Well, let's jump in and we'll talk about some bits of serendipity. I've been studying rock art, specifically Koso rock art. I began publishing on it back in 1983, maybe even earlier, 1980. I could, my master's thesis related to it, as well as an article that I did that was published in the Journal of California and Great Basin Anthropology. And I published, I haven't stopped publishing. And I did a documentary film on it, and my PhD dissertation was published with the Matarango Museum, and then article after article and publication after publication relates to various subjects that have been considered interesting and relevant. So I thought I knew a thing about it, a thing or two about it, but what I had originally recognized was they have an archive, and the archive's on base. And they might have some digital photographs. And I said, you know, I've got hundreds, thousands of pictures all over the base of Koso rock art, but you never know what you're missing. And you don't know what someone else might have seen that you haven't seen. So, Alan, go there, you know, schedule a time and spend a little time, go through whatever digital images they have and download them and get copies of them. So I did that. And surprisingly, I saw quite a number of images that were rather extraordinary and things that I had never seen before and wasn't really sure what they were all about. One of those images was a couple of solid-bodied animal-human figures. The reason I say that, they call them therianthropes or, you know, these zoomorphs. They're figures that are depicted and that may have avian legs and feet and may have feathers or other embellishments on their head. They're obviously either supramundane beings, celestial beings, deities of sorts. Other peoples have called them shamans or religious adepts. So I saw these. I saw two of them on a way up in the Koso Peak, way up about 8,000 feet in the Kosos, about as high as you could get in that area.
Yeah.
And these two figures were both holding snakes in both hands. And these were rather obvious in terms of what kinds of snakes. They were rattlesnakes in both hands. And although the uppermost figure, both of them were rather large, the uppermost figure in part was occluded by sort of water that had alkaline water that had stained the image. Yet the lower one, you could see it definitely was a female. The attributes, the feminine attributes of what they call pendant labia were rather explicit. And besides in both hands having rattlesnakes, they had huge Elko series projectile points, very realistically, very representationally, above both their heads in full display. Really? They were enormous. And wow. I said, boy, that's, if that isn't intriguing, I don't know what is. We do know that Elko series points are temporally diagnostic, chronologically diagnostic. They were most popular during the Middle Archaic, from about 2000 BC to about AD 1. And we know that precisely because we have a lot of radiocarbon dates, a lot of stratigraphic information, chronological information on these, including radiocarbon dates on darts, actual dart points that are connected to these Elko series points, the foreshafts that are made of plant material from dry caves that we have dated. So we're quite certain that at least many, if not most, of those types of projectile points were found during that period. So I said, well, that was interesting. You know, la, 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 sis, boom, ba, put it in the back of my mind. Well, then I'm hiking later on down Little Petroglyph Canyon, which is the only canyon that's open to the general public for their visitation and review. And I see a panel that I haven't seen before, which is amazing because I've been down that canyon so often. And on that panel is a solid-bodied figure that is holding snakes in both of its hands. And I had never seen that before. I said, well, that's interesting. Right. There's a lot of comparison here. We're down at the base. We're at 5,000 feet. We're not at the valley floor in the uplands. But obviously, then there's something going on here. They have recurrent imagery that seems to be communicating the same sort of thing. And the rest of the panel seemed rather ethereal and hard to read. It had five figures around it, and these figures appeared to have their hands upwards towards the sky or the cosmos. And they had something kind of an amorphous blob that looked like, you know, almost like a parachute above them. And then this figure that held the snakes had a definite crescent moon below them. And I go, wow, that's pretty amazing. And so I said, well, yeah, that's interesting. That's amazing. That's wonderful. But what does it all mean? So I put that back in the back of my mind as well. So fast forward a few years later, and I hear about a woman. Her name is Carolyn Boyd. She has a nonprofit rock art foundation in South Texas. It's called Shumla, S-H-U-M-L-A. And she's been studying Pecos rock art. And Pecos rock art is principally paintings. And I believe they date to a similar period, thousands of years old, and they're very elaborate. And she published a book. She'd been studying them for a decade or more. And she publishes a book. It's a hardback book, very long, very complicated, very elaborate, very theoretical. And it wins the Society for American Archaeology Best New Book in Archaeology. And I go, wow, it must be important, right? So I say, I better get a copy of it. It's $60. All right. Spend the $60, get the book. I open it up. I look at it, as I am prone to do on occasion. I go to the back and look at the bibliography. And I'd say 70% of the references are all in Spanish. And I go, that's not going to be much help. I don't read Spanish. You know, I say, what is this book all about? I thought it was about rock art, and I thought it was telling me something. So I tried to read it, can't even follow it. Can't even, it's so complicated and so involved with highly theoretical and other things revolving linguistics and prehistoric population movements and Mesoamerica, which I knew nothing about to speak of. I said, wow. But this is important now, and you have to read this and figure it out. So what do? I go to the back, the index, and I go word by word, and then I trace the word, go back and read the places throughout the book that relate to that particular term. And I begin bit by bit, element by element, you know, chapter, paragraph by paragraph, beginning to understand what she's talking about. It was a real struggle. I also then began to understand by reading the few English versions of literature that references this particular subject, just to get a grasp of what she was talking about. Mm-hmm. It took me 2 years of effort to really figure out what the hell she was talking about. But I finally did. And the reason that I'm bringing this up is she studied a panel, a huge rock art painting that exists in a rock shelter in South Texas. It was part of the Pecos tradition. Mm-hmm. And she argued that that particular panel, that painting, was a record of the sacred narrative or oral traditions, creation stories of ancient Uto-Aztecans. And I go, well, that's interesting.
Really?
Yeah. And I said, well, that's interesting that, you know, kind of parallel, we believe that the Koso people were also ancient Uto-Aztecans. In fact, this is where some people believe that this is the one of the areas that the ancient Uto-Aztecans lived in and, you know, had an ancient homeland or an ancient area in which they lived and prospered early on, very early on in their development. Mm-hmm. Well, what she said is that there was a figure, a major figure in this panel that was a lunar goddess. So we had a lunar goddess. And then around the lunar goddess was the five pilgrims that were following the lunar goddess. The lunar goddess was helping to light the way for the five pilgrims. And they were they were journeying to the spirit mountain to create the sun. And I said, well, that's pretty interesting. And I looked back and I said, well, you know, we have a figure in this one panel that is here in Little Pet, and it has sort of a crescent moon underneath it. And there are five figures surrounding this figure. And so those could, in fact, be similar pilgrims. Interesting.
Yeah.
So there was some parallels there. Well, the more I read in this little book about some of these themes, the more I began to see parallels. One of the things she kept saying was, if you find snakes, specifically rattlesnakes, but other snakes as well, depicted with these figures, those snakes, in fact, have a very important metaphor, meaning deep religious symbolic load. And the snakes have to do with rain. They have to do with rain and life and renewal and revitalization and resurrection and transmogrification, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I said, well, that's interesting. Well, the snakes were up there at the top of Koso Peak, and they looked just like those other ones that she was talking about. Then down below, we see the snakes again. And I said, I said, well, tell me more about this story, Carolyn. You know, what's this creation narrative say? Well, it says that when they got together, they were creating the sun. And when the sun was created, one of them had to commit self-sacrifice and burn themselves up in the fire. And after he was burned here, this particular pilgrim was burned up, he went and became the sun. Now, the sun was created, but because it didn't have enough energy, it was not rising high enough in the heavens. And so the five primordial pilgrims had to do something because the sun was burning up the earth and melting the ice on the high mountains. So what they did was they raised the heavens up, and they were the heavenly pillars to do that. And that's what was being shown in this panel. They were being raised up, and you could see their hands moving up into the clouds, which is the way this story goes, talking about these the five primordial pilgrims, and five being the most important number for Uto Aztecan cultures.
Well, you may have mentioned it, but just kind of taking in this whole story, that panel in Texas that was similar, yes, that spun this whole thing off, did that date to before or after the Coso Range stuff?
She believes it dates to about 2000 BC, which is about the same age as, okay, as the panel, the Middle Archaic. Now, what further prompted my interest, and I didn't come up with this, was a colleague who had studied, one of my students who got her PhD studying Coso rock art. And she came with, mm-hmm, you know, identified the same thing. And we began looking at an inventory of these zoomorphic figures. There was a book that came out about that same time. It was by Caroline Maddock. And she, many years before the high security came and they didn't allow people all over the base, she had a high-ranking husband who was a base executive. And so she was allowed almost freedom to go all over the base, take photographs, and make drawings. And she decided, wow, to examine these decorated animal-human figures.
Okay. Well, I think we'll take our final break and come back on the other side and talk about that for sure, because that sounds amazing. So let's do that. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to the final segment of episode 37 of the Rock Art Podcast. So, all right. So now we're down to the point where we've got this woman who had a high ranking husband on one of the most secure Navy bases, or if not military bases in the world. And she has almost sole privileged access to a lot of rock art. So where do we go from there?
She published a book finally many, many, many years after she did the work. And in that book, she has 450 sketches of,
wow,
what's called decorated animal human figures. They also call them patterned bodied anthropomorphs, mm-hmm, that exist within the Cosos. So what's interesting about that is the conventional wisdom by all people who discuss these particular figures as class of elements within the Coso, you know, canopy, is the conventional wisdom that these are all shamans and they're all men, and that that these are their memorializing their visions and depicting themselves with decorated coats and associated regalia. Well, mm-hmm, that's fine. I can live with that. I thought that was rather interesting. Yet, as both myself and a PhD student from the University of Florida, who had a chance to view them and visit with them and do the same thing over and over again and take hundreds, if not thousands, of photographs during her field work for her PhD dissertation, we began to see something a bit different. We began to classify the figures and examine them for their various attributes and found instead that they were overwhelmingly women. They're women because they have both the genitals, the attributes of their genitals show that. They also have these this hairdo, which is typically identified with women that are coming of age and on their first menses, and this Hopi style hairdo, it's called squash blossoms or butterflies. And in fact, in a number of the cases, it shows them menstruating. There's a stream of blood coming from their genital area. Independent of that, so as we began to study and be looking at that, we were able to examine the 450 different examples of this class. We found that 89 of them were definitively women, 25 were men, and 25 were both had the reproductive organs or were controversial. We could not figure out. There was some means of communicating their gender, but it looked like they were almost androgynous in the sense of having something that we could not definitively identify. Well, if they're females and if they're decorated animal human figures, is it possible that what we were seeing was not just a memorialization or self-identification of a ritualist, but perhaps we're talking about some sort of a deity, some sort of mm-hmm. some sort of a goddess figure. How's that? And so I began to explore that and found that such goddess figures worldwide, when they're called Earth Mothers, or also sometimes animal mistresses, are often shown with weaponry. I go, with weaponry? How can that be? That sounds almost like an oxymoron. It's a paradox. These are women shown with the weapons from men.
Yeah.
But what the point was that these weapons are the symbols of life and death. In other words, it's life because unless men hunted and killed certain key prey animals, they would not eat. They would not have the meat that they need. They also needed those kinds of weapons that are sometimes multi-purpose and used to skin hides and also as tools. And so by depicting that weaponry with this female goddess figure, it produced a meaning or an image, a symbolism having to do with life and death, but also the concept of renewal and regeneration. Well, that's exactly what this lunar goddess figure in ancient Uto-Aztecan, in Mesoamerican metaphor, is intended to communicate. Two cultures that preserve this ancient sort of symbology and ritual and oral tradition as the Huichol in southern United States and Texas and northern Mexico, and the Aztecs. Mm-hmm. And we have that written literature that tells us specifically about a lunar goddess, a female deity that is associated with snakes and that has as its image or as its meaning, as its metaphor, the renewal of the world, the regeneration of animals and people, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Wow.
I went to Mexico City and lectured at one point as a guest scholar. It's one of the highlights of my life. Guanajuato University. And because of that, I was able to go to the Museo de Nacional, which is the museum in Mexico City. And it's supposedly one of the best museums in the world. And I got to see the statue, the famous statue of what they call Coatlicue. Coatlicue is the lunar goddess to the Aztecs. And it was excavated. Mm-hmm. It's a, I don't know, 10, 15 ton statue that stands. Maybe 10, 15 feet tall, right?
Right.
So it certainly is much more impressive than my Coso rock guard. But yet again, it's interesting because Coatlicue, being a lunar goddess, has avian feet and avian legs.
Mm-hmm.
It is considered to be a lunar goddess, and it also is known as... Its name means snake skirt. And so it's formed and also birthing a snake.
Okay.
So there's a lot of overlap in this symbolism of snakes, this metaphor of these creatures. Both the birds and the snakes seem to be part and parcel of this package of meaning and personality or zoomorphic sort of conundrum that exists in the Cosos. And all this is brand new to me. It's like we're reviewing the same information with a whole different prism to examine it entirely differently, if that makes any sense.
All right. So that is super interesting to me because you're talking about, you know, very different areas, different people, but similar ideology and symbology and the way to categorize these things. Now, what could possibly be the reasons for this? And I'll give three things that I'm thinking right now. I mean, sure. One is there's some sort of common thing amongst all these that goes further back, right? So there's a commonality that they all share, and maybe that, you know, those people that share a common descent, you know, spread out, and then these ideas proliferated throughout these cultures in seemingly different areas, but with a common origin. Or is there a common cognitive development that causes them to see the world in very similar ways, in similar spaces, and with similar ideas? Or is it an actual cultural transmission of ideas? Is it, you know, some people saw one thing and it's just transmitted across the landscape, and you've got similar ideas, like religion, you know, translates across the planet today, you know,
right?
Catholicism didn't start in the United States, but we certainly have it here, right?
I mean, exactly.
Right. Or is it, completely random?
Right. Right. And that was troubling to me. And so in writing this original article, I considered all three of those different alternatives.
Yeah.
There may be some sort of common, call it anthropological, genetic connection, linguistic connection from this ancient stratum of Uto-Aztecans from Eastern California to the Hopi, who are Uto-Aztecan, through the Huichol and into the Aztec phenomenon. What I'm talking about in terms of the Aztec understanding and cosmology harkens back to a very ancient underlying stratum of what they even call, and this is a whole other story, an obsidian religion. they've called it an obsidian religion. How can they do that, wow, Alan? Well, in amongst the Aztec, they had enormous quantities of volcanic glass that they used, and their particular deities incorporated the concept of obsidian. One wore obsidian sandals. One was an obsidian mirror. They used obsidian in their sacrifices, etc. Well, if you look back and connect Koso, what a better place to talk about an obsidian religion, because it sat on and was part of one of the largest obsidian trade networks in all of California, going from Eastern California over the Sierras into the Central Valley, across the Coast Range and out to the Channel Islands. And that particular route had been in existence, we know for a fact, for 10,000 years. So there was this ancient connection, volcanic glass to volcanic glass. Also, Koso is a very, you know, it's an area, it's an arid area that is the land of fire. You're looking at Volcano Peak, you're looking at Red Hill Cinder Cone, you're looking at lava flows, you're looking at the Koso Hot Springs, on and on and on. So the area was one that is parallel to the Valley of Mexico in terms of having an active pattern of the landscape of volcanism.
Well, it's essentially the same mountain range down there, isn't it? It just extends on down.
Yeah,
the whole feature and series of mountain ranges, they extend right into Mexico.
Exactly. And so also the linguists have told me that this is a area that the modern linguists have now begun to believe, growing evidence, that ancient Uto-Aztecan, proto-Uto-Aztecan people may in fact have lived and developed their culture as hunter-gatherers in a pre-civilization, pre-sedentary nature as foragers at a very, very early time. And so what I'm talking about in terms of the iconography is one that is ancient. We're talking about a pattern that goes from, let's say, 6,000 BC to about 2,000 BC, way, way early. So we're talking about a 4,000 to 10,000 year old set of patterns. The imagery I'm talking about often is very old. It's the oldest set of representational images. It's overlaid by more recent kinds of imagery. So when this pattern occurred, when this ritualistic ideational deification of women occurred, was a very early one, and it was replaced by a principally androcentric or male-centered cosmology later in time. You don't see the same emphasis. You see men, you see them being, you know, identified as males in terms of their gender and their genitals. You see them hunting, actively hunting. And this feminine beginnings, this matriarchal set of images is still recognized, and it's also refreshed, but it's not developed. So it's much more diminutive and overtaken by a whole other set of imagery, principally related to bighorn sheep. Hmm. If you understand what I'm saying, there's just a whole different set of patterns and strategies going on. Wow. So it's an interesting story, and I'm still working out the details, but the data itself is interesting and somewhat compelling in indicating some sort of parallels and some sort of different set of activities heretofore really unrecognized in the literature when we talk about COSO research.
Well, we only have a couple minutes left. So, I mean, what's the final conclusion here? What's next?
Well, two things are next. One is to sort of polish up a decent lengthy article, and the other is to publish a book that deals with the imagery and the possibility of the linguistic and ethnic connections between COSO and the American Southwest moving into Mexico. And I know that's going to be rather controversial. You think?
Right. And maybe a companion podcast series on the whole topic.
Oh, yes. There you go. Yes. I like it. I like it.
All right. Well, this has been great. Thanks, Alan, for this.
You're welcome.
Like you said, we're going to talk about this kind of stuff a lot more. And I've actually got some ideas for some podcast stuff related to this. Look for that on the APN at some point in the future. But anyway, thanks for that. And we will be back next week with another amazing topic. I don't know what it is.
Thanks. Thanks so much for entertaining the notion of listening to me. God bless you all, and see you next week.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. You can find this podcast on the educational podcast app Lyceum, Lyceum, and wherever you find podcasts. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.